is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian bunker, once again, we arrive together here on our foray into Fortiana. It is the Grahamian Report. Glad, as always, to be with you. So tonight, we've got quite a lot to cover. I'm seeing those winds of change once again. And this time, the direction they are blowing is ever onward into the future. And where it takes us as team civilization. That's right, humanity moving ever forward. Well, I tell you, interesting times indeed. I'll explain a little more later, because the more that we are affected by communication, technology, the furtherance of our own innovation, well, the further out we're beginning to look. And many would argue that, well, now we're beginning to kind of get an idea about where to look for life out there, what else might exist in the universe, and of course that could be a real game changer, perhaps the greatest of all. In addition, of course, to that, we'll be discussing other news that's happening. I'll be updating you on recent happenings here in Asheville, North Carolina, where we had a remarkable event recently, and many other various sundry things. So welcome. Let's get things rolling, shall we? Glad, as always, to be able to correspond with you guys. Got a lot of great emails. One in particular from a young lady who sends along some of the absolutely most insightful commentary that I get on this show. And really looking forward to that message a little later. But first, yes, it is August here. Well, the end of August. Hard to believe that September is already nearly upon us. And this time of the year, usually I'm kind of gearing up for a lot of conferences and things that I'm going to. This year has been different, however. This year has been different because rather than a conference, the only real significant event that I have booked up is the final week of September for the Ancient Mysteries Cruise. I believe it's now sold out, unfortunately, but I know a few of you out there in the listening audience, quite a few in fact, will be attending, so looking forward to seeing you guys there. We'll be headed down to, Roatan, Costa Maya, a lot of those locations, heading out to see the actual Mayan ruins at those locations, too. And we did one of these cruises a few years ago. That was a lot of fun. David Childress, Robert Shaw, Hugh Newman, and I, we all went out together, and we visited Tulum. And there was one really kind of odd thing that happened there at Tulum, is Robert Schock was taking us around. With his background in geology, he's explaining the various different kinds of stone that were used in the workings and the buildings and structures there at the Tulum site. But I remember, and I took a photo of this too, there was what looked like a tiny human footprint, about maybe 5 inches long. And it was embedded in the stone, not over by the buildings, but kind of off right at the edge of the jungle. And there were all these huge iguanas crawling around. But right there where the brush began to take you back down the hill and into the forest that we had walked up out of, there was this little flat stone. And it wasn't some sort of a monument or anything. I mean, it looked like it was totally naturally placed. It looked like it had been there for eons, for all I know. But yeah, there was this clear, very small, what looked like a human footprint. And I showed it to a couple of the other cruise goers. I said, "What does that look like to you?" And they said, "Wow, that's like a little footprint." Now, I'm under the impression that the impression in the stone itself was probably something natural that just happened to look like a foot. Paradelia, probably. But I did take a photo just that I could show this to other people. And over the years, I've done so. And every time, people are like, "Oh, wow, is that a footprint?" So rather than a big foot, maybe a baby foot. But yeah, we found that while we were there. And looking forward to getting back down and doing that. But that was one thing that I had booked for this fall. And then the other thing, of course, was the George Norrie Live event, which we mentioned on the show last week. And boy, it was great. Diana Wortham Theater seats a little more than 500 people, and they just about sold out. There were a few empty seats up in balcony areas, but I think that for the most part, it was one of the best turnouts for a single night kind of an event like that I've ever done. And the meet and greet afterward was crazy. I mean, I know a lot of you out there listening were in attendance. We had a couple fly down from Chicago. There was a couple that came up from Florida. We have had people from all over the Western North Carolina, Georgia, South Carolina region.
Yeah, it was quite interesting, though, the range of the demographic, and also, of course, just the attendance in general. And it's funny how many people live right here in town who would come to an event like that and said, well, I've been a fan of you for years. And I'm thinking, oh, really? How have we not met yet? Dave Butler of Harold's Pawn Shop came out and not only brought me a T-shirt, but we were able to meet the following afternoon at the wonderful Sovereign Remedies, Matthew Oakley, the Graylian Reverend himself, who initially was going to be in studio, but we had to kind of flip-flop things because I'm getting so caught up, or I had fallen so behind schedule. So now, officially, I'm getting caught up by finishing this show. Got the subscriber shows, middle theories done, and of course, the 1 week where I'm having all this happening, McNonymous had a conflict as well. So Matthew Oakley to the rescue. But I told him I could really use you on middle theory rather than on Graylian. So here we are together. And we were all together again over the weekend. Yes, George Norrie and William R. Forstgen, my old cousin Joshua P. Warren. Quite interesting. Quite a motley crew, in fact. But we really had a good time. And I never really had a whole lot of one-on-one time outside of a business setting like that with George. But he came into town on Friday, and we all met for dinner, and he and Tom Danheiser and I and all of the speakers, we're all kind of meeting up. And I kind of thought, you know, it'll be cool. I'll get to talk to George a bit. No. Here I end up, Matt Oakley and I, sitting at the very end of the table. I'm right across from George, sitting right next to Tom Danheiser, and we're all talking about music and movies. But there were some kind of weird synchronicities because, again, this was just a really, off-the-cuff kind of thing. George was having a glass of wine. Tom and I were having the Green Man ESB, a favorite dark beer of mine here that's produced in Asheville. And as we're sitting there talking, George just out of the blue asks, Micah, have you ever watched Breaking Bad? And I thought, I actually said this to him. I said, why would you ask me that? Now, here's the backstory. This is kind of funny. I have always enjoyed chemistry, and I really like physics and astronomy. But so science-themed shows, or shows that incorporate a bit of that, tend to be very appealing to me. You know, House is another show that comes to mind. There are a lot of shows like this. But, and actually tell you the truth, that's another thing I love about Doctor Who. There was a particular episode in the last season, which was called Before the Flood. And the beginning of the show, it opens with Capaldi's Doctor walking around the TARDIS, and he's breaking the third wall, which means, of course, he's talking directly to the audience. But he's explaining something that was described in a Robert Heinlein novel called The Bootstrap Paradox. And he says, if you aren't familiar with it, Google it. And it's talking about basically which came first, the chicken or the egg, as it relates to time travel. It's a great paradox. In fact, it's one of my favorites. And the fact that they incorporate those kind of philosophical and physical dilemmas, these paradoxes, into that program, that's something I love about this show. So anyway, science-themed shows really kind of are my favorites. And so I thought eventually I'd get around to watching Breaking Bad. And I only recently did, and it's taken me a little while to kind of get into it. It is a rather dark show. But Bryan Cranston's performance is just quite remarkable. I had a lot of work to catch up on Friday before the dinner, and I didn't really feel like going out to dinner, honestly. I was like, oh, I'm so busy, and I'm going to be working all day tomorrow. No time for leisure. So I just was having to kind of will myself into wanting to go out, and I thought, you know, the best way to do this is not going to be work up until the moment I leave. I need to decompress a little so that I'll feel, you know, a little bit more relaxed when I have to leave here. And so I said, rather than forcing myself to churn out articles and get stuff together for tomorrow and lay out clothes and you know, tie up together loose ends, whatever, you know, get music equipment and things, because keep in mind, the band and I performed. I'll get to that in a moment. Yeah, I thought, instead of doing all that junk, I'm just going to decompress. And so I get on Netflix and I watch Breaking Bad. And I'm catching up on the misadventures of Walter White and Jesse. And I do that, and then I decompress a bit and then head off to dinner. So how funny that I would be watching that show, only recently began, and I get to dinner after having been watching an episode an hour before George Norrie asks me, Mike, have you ever watched Breaking Bad? And I thought, how bizarre. And I told him, and I said, boy, that's a bit synchronistic. And I said, while on the subject of synchronicities, I said, George, I've got to tell you, years ago I had this dream that you came to Asheville for like a barbecue or a picnic or something. And I remember at the time laughing about it and saying, now why would George Norrie ever come to Asheville? And so we all kind of marveled at the weird little synchronicities. George talked about some of his own experiences. You know, Tommy had said that he'd had some too. And that they loved to discuss those coincidences and things like that that would happen with all the people that they talk with and all the different connections they make. We talked a little bit about Art Bell. I won't say very much about that, but I will say this much. I'd always wanted to talk privately with George about the way that Art had, well, you know, kind of famously gone toe-to-toe with them. So I know that's a bit of a controversial subject. So it was kind of interesting. There wasn't anything, you know, said that was negative in truth. I find George and Tom to be just absolute gentlemen, and they're real fun to be around when you're not actually having to work. So the next day we're there, and the band and I arrive, and we're backstage at the beautiful Thomas Wolfe Theater, and George shows up, and we're getting things dialed in. The sound there is excellent. So the band goes into the rehearsal, and Tommy had told me, Tom Danheiser, he said, now listen, you know, George, he's pretty specific about how he likes these songs to be played and everything. So they had allocated about 2 hours for the rehearsal, and George had said, you know, I don't want to blow my voice out, but I'm going to be singing these 4 songs, and so I'm going to listen to you guys play through each one instrumentally one time, and then I'll sing along to it the second time through. So the 4 songs were I Can't Help Falling in Love with You by Elvis, and then we did Engelbert Humperdinck, Love Me with All of Your Heart. We did Frank Sinatra, Time After Time, and then Nat King Cole, When I Fall in Love, which is actually a great song. Really like that one. And so we start with the Elvis song, and we go into it, and I give a cue to George. And all I say is, this is where you would start singing as we're about to go into the vocals. And he takes it away. He starts singing. He's actually a pretty good singer. And there are videos online where you can find George singing. And it was kind of surreal because we start playing this song. He doesn't wait and listen. He just goes ahead and starts singing. And he strolls off the stage over into the corner and leans against the wall in the darkness. They've dimmed the entire house lights and they're testing the spotlights. The spotlights are over on the band. But he kind of strolls off to the far end of the stage and just leans against the wall, standing in the dark, and sings these songs. And then at one point, he kind of strolls out into the theater, the empty Dinah Wortham Theater, and he's walking around singing. Got a wireless microphone, of course. And I'd recommended that he should do that to test and make sure that the mic wouldn't feed back or anything prior to the show, because he, at times, would walk out into the audience a bit. But here he is, he's kind of, and he's always off in the shadows. You know, I could see generally where he was. And would you believe we did each song once, and we were done in 25 minutes. The entire 2 hours that we'd allotted, we were done in 25 minutes. Afterward, Tommy comes up and he says, you know, hope things went well. I know he's so specific about how he likes these songs. And I said, well, I mean, we're done, and we played each song once. And he says, you mean you're done with the whole practice already? And I said, yeah. Yeah, he sang each song one time. We got it in the first take. I mean, there were a couple of little rough spots, but I can tell you at the show later that night, everything went completely smooth. It was perfect. And so it was really relaxed and really a fun time, but it didn't feel like an event. It felt like a great big party. I mean, the audience was interacting so well, and they actually had us get out there and play a few songs at the beginning. And so we sang. We did L.A. Woman by The Doors, Dire Straits, Sultans of Swing, an all-time favorite of mine. And we had more people after the show at the meet and greet saying, wow, I couldn't believe some of the songs you guys selected. I mean, you guys, we always hear you say that you play guitar, but Michael, wow, you guys really play. I mean, you really play. And I said, well, did you think I was kidding? Did you think we were going to be up there strumming ukuleles or something? No. There was a lot of work that went into it, and I think it was just a stellar event. I hope they'll come back. But yeah, we certainly had a lot of fun. And there were some unique little synchronicities that occurred along the way too, which I always find fun. I had a lot of people back in February when I talked about the trip out to Big Bear Lake and how, you know, spiritually significant it was in a lot of ways. And more people wrote to me after that show and they said, not only do we enjoy that storytelling aspect of you recounting an experience like that, but it's so neat the way that you seem to be so open to the various unusual little threads. Those little synchronicities and those little coincidences and those little otherwise meaningful experiences that you describe. And more people said that was absolutely our favorite episode of the Graylian Report. And indeed, I find that if you are open to that, and I'm not saying just look for stuff, make stuff up. Oh my gosh, there it is again. It's 11:11 on the clock. Wow, synchronicity. I mean, honestly, that sort of stuff. I'd written about it on Facebook a while back, and one of our city councilmen here in Asheville had responded. And Cecil Bothwell, who I've mentioned in the past on the show because he had an interesting UFO experience. He and his late partner of a number of years, the two of them had been, I think, it may have been around New Hampshire. I knew they lived up further north, but they both saw this thing. And he told her, okay, afterward, go into the next room and I'm going to sit here and we're going to both write up descriptions and draw what we saw. He said it was a classic red glowing disc-shaped object. They hovered over the highway a short distance away. It was in the middle of the night, and they saw the thing take off at incredible speed. Yeah. But when it came to the synchronicity discussion, Cecil's response was, these are just things that you see because, you know, you spot them, and you only remember them because when you look at the clock and you see 11:11, I mean, you look at the clock all the time. You only remember the ones where there seems to be a significant number. That's all this is. It's just your brain just doing stuff. Okay, maybe it's just my brain doing stuff when I'm sitting and watching Breaking Bad, and then 25 minutes later, George Norrie says, Mike, have you ever watched Breaking Bad? You know, maybe it's a synchronicity. You know, when I dream the night before, I learn of a band getting back together. I dream about that band having a rehearsal, but they can't find their singer. And the next day, the band not only is getting back together, but the singer isn't going to be in this particular lineup any longer. Maybe it's a synchronicity when I see a man's name on a grave and then find out the following day that that individual, a parishioner at my father's church, had actually passed away. Do I think I'm psychic? No. I really don't. I look at those things as being coincidences. Many others look at them as being something else. Some people think that indeed that there is something psychic going on. I couldn't tell you. I mean, I have to say I'm pretty skeptical of people who, again, will claim that they can read the future or that they can read something off of you. My experiences with psychics have been very few in terms of those that really maybe go, huh. There have been a couple of instances where people seem to have really been spot on, and I don't doubt that there are some people who are able to, in some way, interpret things outside of the known senses. But maybe this isn't something that's magical or paranormal. Maybe there is something to this. Now, people get upset when I say that, because I think a lot of people want magic, and they want the paranormal in their lives, and that's okay. But I'm not saying that these things can't exist. I'm saying maybe there are processes of nature that do exist, which could indeed, if better understood, could account for why people have these kinds of experiences and could help us understand the nature of synchronicity. They could help us understand the apparent ability some people have of prescience, of being able to know things, having foreknowledge, psychic or otherwise. There very well could be instances where this does happen. There very well could be forces of nature that could explain these kinds of things. And with our current inability to explain those things or account for them in the more valid instances where they do occur, we would call these things paranormal. But there's this stigma that becomes attached to that idea of paranormalia, and the modern skeptic mind has to try and say that, well, if there's no good evidence, we must now create the argument against and say that it couldn't be, therefore it isn't. Which I always say isn't, to me, really good skepticism. We've got to be open-minded, but by the same token, I think that we can also be logical about our open-mindedness. That is important. But these kind of things, I do notice them from time to time. They happen to me. I know George said that they've happened to him. I've talked to a lot of people who have said that these kind of things have happened to them. One more quick story, because I do know that I mentioned this briefly on the Middle Theory podcast this week, but not all of the listenership listens to both shows, so I'll mention this here. William R. Forstjen was one of the other guests. Again, it was me and my cousin Joshua P. Warren. He's well-known in the paranormal communities. And then Forstjen. Yes, Josh and I are fourth cousins, so we're distantly related, but nonetheless, there's that weird story about that, which I've told in the past on this show, involving a photograph and the disappearance of a man named Claude Calloway, which at some point I may revisit. But the other speaker was William R. Forstjen, and he is a New York Times best-selling author, and of course, he's probably best known these days for the book One Second After, and there was a sequel to that. He's got another book coming out also next January. Bill's kind of a funny guy. I like him. I've known him for years. But Bill is, he's very different from in terms of his personality and his charisma. He's a little different from the way I do it. I mean, he's a professor. He's a historian. I think he's semi-retired, but he taught for years and still does some teaching at Montreat College. One of the most knowledgeable guys. And despite his very calm and kind of reserved demeanor, there is a certain charisma about Forstjen. And he'll also, from time to time, you'll hear him on the radio here in town, and he'll come in and he'll host, especially around the time of D-Day or something like that. And his narrative, the way he'll tell these stories about the history of war, it's incredible. He's really good. And as he was sitting there with me, we were side by side there at the table for the meet and greet, and he says, you know, Mike, I got to tell you a story. He said, I was up there at a book signing with Newt Gingrich. That's right, he and Newt have written a lot of books, co-authored over the years, and Newt also wrote the foreword for One Second After. Well, anyway, Bill says, Mike, I was up there with Newt, and this is kind of funny because Newt doesn't like doing security at book signings like this. He doesn't like having any security there, and he says the creepiest thing that ever happened to me, Mike, at a book signing was this guy comes up, and we'd seen the guy come up, and he a distance away looked kind of menacing, but by the time he got up to our table, we were really, really weirded out by this guy. He was dressed in period clothing. He had this scowl on his face, didn't say a word. But he took a copy of our book and he pushed it across the table to us, and then he laid his business card down on the table. And according to his business card, he was a John Wilkes Booth impersonator. And Bill says, you know, Newt and I looked at each other, and we're just thinking, whoa, what's this guy all about? And people had said, in fact, Newt actually had been told by folks there in the D.C. area that this guy was crazy, and this guy was certifiable. Now, who knows who he actually is or who he was, or if it was just intended as a very dark-humored joke. But he said that was really unsettling when, again, for those, if you don't remember, okay, let's discuss history. John Wilkes Booth, of course, the famous assassin, President Lincoln. And a John Wilkes Booth impersonator, Matt Oakley commented on this. He said, well, you know, exactly how often is there really much of a demand for John Wilkes Booth impersonators? You might be surprised, actually. You really might be surprised. But indeed, that is kind of an odd story, and certainly Bill said the most disturbing that he'd ever experienced. Also kind of disturbing, looking at the news right now, and speaking of patriotism, bald eagles have been found dead. Unlucky number 13, in fact. That's right, 13 bald eagles along Maryland's eastern shore. Nobody knows exactly what led to them dying, but the carcasses were discovered. Okay, and according to federal wildlife experts, they say that finding enough evidence to identify the culprit in what is right now being cited as the single largest die-off of bald eagles in the state in 30 years, it's been so difficult. They're calling it a real mystery. Now, the case of the dead eagles found 6 months ago was reported by the Washington Post. They said that they were found in a field in Federalsburg, and it drew national attention. The investigators from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have never really been involved in something quite so complex. The carcasses were sent to a lab out in Oregon. There was even a $25,000 reward that was offered. But authorities now say they don't have enough evidence to prosecute anybody in the crime. They say none of the leads have even been fruitful. We haven't even found success with a single lead, in fact, according to Terry Edwards, a Fish and Wildlife spokesperson. Now, many eagle experts speculated that these birds could have come into contact with a pesticide at a local farm and that this might be what had killed them, but one would presume that if this were the case, that other species would have been affected too, right? Federal investigators said that they received a number of leads and put in considerable effort in chasing them, but nothing turned up despite the idea of the pesticides. Officials with the Fish and Wildlife Service wouldn't detail this week any of the findings in their investigation. They also said they weren't sure when the case would officially close. But as yet, or at least as of now, this remains a mystery. And speaking of bizarre animal deaths, this is another one that's got a lot of us scratching our heads. My buddy John Bernier sent this along via Twitter. Yeah, lightning during a recent thunderstorm in Norway apparently killed a herd of 323 reindeer. 70 of them were just calves. And this is, again, one of the most deadly lightning strikes that has ever occurred due to the number of deaths. Hunters in a remote area discovered the bodies last Friday. This according to the Norwegian news agency. Now, you know, we usually hear about lightning strikes and people who are affected by this. The Verge reported on this. But as they wrote, it does kill animals too. Two scientists at an Australian research institute have found that everything from seal pups to wild turkeys to elephants and giraffes have been killed by lightning in this way. Just never in quite such a huge number. Now, the question is, was this a freak accident? How common is this sort of thing? Could this sort of a thing explain certain mass animal killings that have been reported over the years, even in certain Fortean literature? Now, according to John Jensensius, a lightning safety expert from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, he says it isn't unusual to see farm animals or wild animals such as reindeer being killed by lightning, but yeah, 323 of them is a pretty large number. Now, he says we have seen reports of up to 654 sheep being killed in a single spot. That's pretty significant too, huh? Animals, he says, do tend to group together in storms and huddle under trees. Now, if lightning strikes that tree, or even if it strikes somewhere nearby, the entire group can be killed. Now, we don't know how common this is because it's hard to track. Usually, though, it's herds of 10 to 20 animals that get killed like this. Now, in a case, he says, where the animals are huddling under a tree, oftentimes you'll see some visible signs on that tree, though you may not see any visible signs on the animals themselves. In this case, it's hard to know where lightning struck based on the pictures, but there may be an animal among the dead animals that has those visible signs and a bit of charring on the skin. So apparently, what I'm interpreting here is that the reindeer killing right now seems quite conclusively a lightning strike, but there doesn't really appear to be enough evidence right now, at least based on photos taken by the hunters in that region, to say that, yeah, sure, this is exactly what happened. But they nonetheless may be able to correlate that with weather patterns in the region. Now, lightning, he said, goes up one leg and down the other. Animals are more vulnerable because their legs are spread out more, so the ground currents travel more easily in their bodies. But it doesn't matter if they're touching or exactly how close they are. All that matters, really, is that they were all in the area hit by the lightning. Ground currents are the thing that's responsible for most lightning deaths and injuries, and that's both in people and animals. But he also, Jensensius, says that lightning deaths that result in, well, human deaths, that those numbers are actually dropping. He says if you look all the way back to the 1930s and 40s, we had about 300 to 400 people killed every year in the United States by lightning strikes. Nowadays, our 10-year average is really just about 31 people per year. So far this year, we've had 32. So it's good to know that those numbers are dropping in midst of the mysteries that have led to animal deaths elsewhere. I couldn't help but think, though, that maybe the lightning hypothesis is something that should be looked at with other certain mass animal deaths that have occurred and have been reported. Some, I think, even that were reported by Charles Fort, you know, way back in the day. So, while looking back here, we'll look ahead here in a moment. After this break, it is the Greylane Report. Stay with us.
From the swamps of the LaRue Bayou to the depths of the Greylane Bunker, it's former WCW and WWE professional wrestler, the Raging Cajun, Lash LaRue, and you are listening to my friend and my brother, Micah Hanks, on the Greylane Report. Ha ha!
The dark hills of Appalachia, here in the high mountains. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Greylane Report. You gotta laugh. It's kind of funny who you end up getting to know in a business like this. And yes, you just heard from the one and only. And yes, he is indeed my brother down in the LaRue Bayou, Lash LaRue. We had a message we featured on the show a few weeks ago from Lash. And he and I have remained in touch. I've told him, and I'll say this because I know you're listening, Lash. We're going to get you on the show at some point. I want to have you on and either do a roundtable or maybe just you and I just rap for a while, because Lash has got so many cool ideas about things, right? Everything from simulated universe hypotheses to artificial intelligence, dimensionality, you know, all this sort of stuff. Really a cool person. I didn't ask him to do that. He just sent along that awesome drop and said, you know, here, if you ever want to, and don't feel obligated, but... Oh, God, how do you not use something like that? That is one of the coolest things I think I've heard in a long time. And I know a lot of the classic wrestling fans out there will really be tickled when they hear one of their favorite wrestlers. And boy, if you've ever seen Lash, I tell you, there are a lot of great video compilations of him on YouTube. He was quite a talent, and he knows this, but you guys need to check him out. If you're a wrestling fan, again, I know a lot of them out there are going to be like, just bowling over right now, having heard that. So, Lash, thank you so much, man. It's always cool to hear from you. Speaking of cool, I like my coffee warm. And this morning, I was cleaning my famous coffee mug, Keep Calm in Time Travel, that Aunt Purple bought for me. Yes, that's right, I have an aunt. Well, she's an adopted aunt, really a friend, but nonetheless, her nickname is Aunt Purple, so... Or Aunt Purple, as we'd say down here in the South, right? keep calm in time travel. We went on a trip, she and a few friends and I, down to Sullivan's Island. And she invited me to come along because she knew that I liked researching history, and this, of course, had been a famous haunt, for a while at least, of Edgar Allan Poe, and thereafter, following in his footsteps, H.P. Lovecraft often visited that area. And so she bought me this coffee mug so that when I arrived, this would be my gift, and every morning I'd have my coffee in this mug. And now, ever since then, every morning I still drink my coffee in the time travel mug. And from time to time, you know, with a white interior like that especially, you've got to clean it because of the coffee stains. And it's very famous, of course, the coffee rings that you'll see on paper, you know, notorious coffee drinkers. You'll find them all around the Greyland bunker from time to time. Though I do indeed try to keep the coffee off of the tabletops and the surfaces from time to time. I'll fail, and there'll be a little coffee ring. Or I'll have, and this is very classic for a writer, but I'll have paper documents lying around, and there'll be a coffee ring on them. But did you know that there's actually a physical mystery about what they call, scientists, the coffee ring effect? I don't know, maybe a few of you guys have heard about this. The coffee ring effect is, again, that pattern you get when a single liquid evaporates and leaves behind a ring of previously dissolved solids. But in the case of coffee, that would be the coffee grounds. Well, a new paper that appeared in Physical Review E demonstrates that we still have a lot to learn about this seemingly simple everyday occurrence. Yeah, physicists know that the ring occurs because the liquid evaporates more quickly at the edges of the drop than at the center. And so the remaining liquid at the center will flow outward to the edges to fill the gaps, dragging particles like coffee grounds along with it. Now those particles stick to the surface at the edges of the ring and hence the dark outline around the stain. You probably are thinking, wow, I never knew there was so much to the chemistry of what makes a coffee ring. But I promise it gets more interesting. The more you know about the various forces at play during this process, you see, the better we can predict where those grounds are going to end up. Now, Gizmodo reports that physicists engaged in fluid dynamics research are naturally keen to learn more about the coffee ring effect. It doesn't just appear in coffee. Whiskey will also leave telltale signs, as will any other liquid with tiny particles suspended in it. Blood, paint, ink, all of these. Now, Lehigh University graduate student Bayushi accidentally spilled her coffee one morning in the lab, and just as she was about to clean it up, her advisor, Edmund Webb, stopped her. He says, "Don't do it!" That inspired them to run their own computer simulation of how a drop spreads out on a flat surface. They didn't simulate coffee, however, but a drop of lead filled with tiny copper particles on a copper surface, which simplifies the physics just a bit, the better to calculate all the forces involved. And they used surfaces with different crystal structures to get a better idea of how the spreading of the drops can vary and what impact this has had, or if and how the particles eventually stick to the surface at the outer edges of the resulting ring. She and Webb's simulation showed that a very thin film will form on the surface just ahead of the spreading droplet, and unlike the drop, it doesn't stop spreading once the dark outer ring has formed. But here's the funny thing. They aren't really sure why this happens. They say more experiments and simulations will no doubt be in order, but if physicists can crack the mystery, they'll be able to manipulate these kinds of liquids at the nanoscale, opening up a host of potential applications in medicine and high-tech manufacturing. So again, something so seemingly inconsequential as spilling your coffee can lead to new innovations that we might be able to utilize with nanotech, medicine, manufacturing, who knows what else. I mean, there's a lot of potential applications. And as an unapologetic lover of coffee, I have to say I think that's kind of cool. This, on the other hand, is not cool. We have breaking news just an hour and some change south of the Greyland Bunker. Well, being underground, it's hard to go further south, but no, this is like something right out of a horror film. In Greenville, South Carolina, there is apparently something happening. According to residents at the Fleetwood Manor apartment, there is a person who has been described as dressing like a clown who has been seen trying to lure kids into the woods. There was a note posted, and it says as follows. I'm going to read from the actual screen grab here. To the residents of Fleetwood Manor, there has been several conversations and a lot of complaints to the office regarding a clown or a person dressed in clown clothing taking children or trying to lure children in the woods. First and foremost, at Fleetwood Manor Apartments, children's safety is a top priority. At no time should a child be alone at night or walking in the roads or wooded areas at night. Also, if a person or persons are seen, you are to immediately call the police. Greenville County Police Department is aware of the situation and have been riding the property daily. Remember, there is a 10 p.m. curfew for the property now so as to ensure your children's safety. And please be advised to keep them in the house. Now, Yeah, you probably know exactly what horror film I'm talking about. Although It isn't the only representation of a freaky clown. I mean, this has become kind of an element of Americana and Fortiana. Lauren Coleman years ago wrote about clowns. And again, I think one of the popular memes that appears in urban legends is the creepy clown that abducts children in a van. Or as Adam Sane of the Conspiranormal podcast called it on the telephone yesterday, or 2 days ago. What did he call it? He said the satanic abduction van. Is that... I was on the phone with him, and it was kind of weird. A white van with all black tinted windows, no markings whatsoever on the van, speeds by my house outside. And I said, wow, that's creepy. That looks like one of those government vans. He said, no, Micah, that's the satanic abduction van. We laughed about that. And of course, then there's that further legend that, and you'll find articles about this online, Asheville, North Carolina, satanic capital of the world. Oh, give me a break. I'm not sure where that legend actually came from, but there are a lot of silly urban legends about Asheville being just a center for satanic ritual abuse in all of America. Yeah, it's yeah. I know I can't explain it either. So, but there it is. I've heard stories over the years about all kinds of crazy occult rituals. There was one story that was told to me years ago about this crazy big house where these alleged sacrificial killings and things would happen. There are stories about, you know, all kinds of stuff up on the Blue Ridge Parkway. There was a woman who used to come here to Asheville to research this and claim that she had spoken with people who had claimed that they had been abused or they had been a part of the entire thing. There were even legends about the old Asheville College, which at one time was housed in a famous castle on top of Town Mountain, or Bowcatcher Mountain, as it were, and that at some point that there may have been rituals associated with that. But I found no evidence whatsoever that there's really any legitimacy to that, apart from just these kinds of little local legends that come about from time to time. But the whole thing about clowns is a little different. Because, again, from time to time, I think that the popularity of this meme has led some people, whether for purpose of weird photographic, art projects, to just, frankly, just trying to freak people out. People dressing like weird clowns. I'm sorry, there's also that John Wayne Gacy connection. You know, here we have a serial killer, notorious serial killer, who would dress as a clown. And not just dress as a clown, I mean, he actually worked as a party clown. So while he's taking young men home and murdering them by night, by day he's going to, you know, birthday parties and things for the kids down the street and dressing like a clown. They said that Gacy was known from time to time, at least on a couple of occasions, to stop by a local bar on his way home from these events, and he would come in dressed in full clown regalia, stop in and have a drink. Oh. Now, WFMY News 2 reported out of Greenville in response to these reports of this creepy clown lurking around in the forest and trying to get the attention of children. The apartment had apparently sent out this letter that I read, and explained in the letter the Greenville County law enforcement are now saying that they're conducting daily patrols of that neighborhood because of the reports. I would advise, if you are in the Greenville area, to contact the Greenville County Police Department if you see anyone lurking in the forest, especially if they look like they're dressed like a clown. Oh, yeah, talk about creepy. I can do without a creepy clown. Although I'm sure, you know, with the remake of It, we're going to be seeing another one here before long. So that'll only be a few weeks away, I suppose. Maybe we'll have to revisit some Halloween-themed things as we get closer to the end of October. Hey, it's only the beginning of September yet. Well, almost. Many of you, by the time you're listening, it will be. But hey, we're time travelers, right? It can be any time we want it to be. Time for a break. We'll be back right after this here on the Graylian Report. Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. This is a no creepy clown zone. Creepy clown free zone. Okay, you understand? Yeah. I'll also say that the Hadals, our little underlings here in the underworld, they feed on creepy clowns. So keep out. Speaking of keep out, you know, that was the title of a book that was written a few years ago by my friend Nick Redfern. And someone had emailed a while back, and I think that they'd asked for us to comment a bit on some of the MIB folklore. And when we're talking about folklore in America, again, you know, there is something I'd mentioned in the last segment that Lauren Coleman had written years ago about some genuine instances where there were clowns that would show up in vans and would try and get children to get on board. And I presume that the idea here, in the events where this has allegedly happened, and I say allegedly because it's almost become a folkloric kind of a motif, although I don't doubt that there have been real instances where clowns have tried to abduct children. The whole idea here is that the clown is something that the child identifies with as being friendly and fun, which, if you think about it, as we've talked about many times in the past on this show, a clown is anything but friendly and fun and inviting. I mean, thanks to this creepy clown motif, there's nothing creepier than clowns. And so there's like a, what's the organization called? I think it's like the American Clown Association or something like that, or the American Association of Professional Clowns. You can look it up, but there is an organization of professional clown, you know, people who work as clowns, you know, at birthday parties and things, and they lobby for the rehabilitation of clowns. Not those who have gone around kidnapping people, but they want the image of the clown not to be skewed. And so they really had protested, like, for instance, American Horror Story and other programs and media that have helped proliferate this creepy clown imagery in American culture. Isn't that weird? It is pretty weird to me. But another thing, though, I'd mentioned Nick Redfern. And as far as these tropes in American culture, the MIB is another one. And MIBs in folklore are kind of a kind of a broader reaching thing. It's not just men who show up after you've seen a UFO and tell you to keep your mouth shut. There's kind of a darker element to the MIB mythos. And a while back I spoke with Nick about this, and he had talked about MIBs and the presence of that darkness and their element associated with the MIB in American folklore and also in folklore from other parts of the world. Here's what he had to say.
Albert Bender was born in the early 1920s. And grew up and lived in a place called Bridgeport, Connecticut. And as you pointed out, in the early 50s, he was actually living in the sort of attic part of his stepfather's house. And Bender was someone who not only had a deep interest in UFOs, but also the occult and the paranormal, both in the real world and in fiction. So in other words, you know, he was into Ouija boards and, you know, real-life ghost stories, but he was also into sort of, you know, gothic horror novels, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, Mary Shelley, that sort of thing. And he I won't say lived an unusual life, I just say he lived an alternative life. You know, he was someone who, he lived in this attic, and he painted the walls with sort of like monster-type faces on them, and, you know, he'd invite friends over, and there would be sort of rubber spiders hanging from the ceiling and things like that, and you know, so he's a bit of an unusual character, shall we say. But he set up in the early 50s a group called the International Flying Saucer Bureau. And this was basically like an early version of MUFON or something like that. But I think Bender really just set it up with the idea that, you know, it would get sort of a local interest and maybe it would go a bit further than local. You know, and he'd develop a network of friends and colleagues and they'd chat about UFOs. Well, it didn't quite go like that. What happened was that, for whatever reason, the IFSB attracted massive interest all around the world. And, for example, there were chapters opened in England, in Australia. And, I mean, it became a huge organization. You know, Bender spent his nights just tirelessly answering mail by the sackload, you know, and he had a massive circulation and subscription for his magazine. And so all was going well until Bender suddenly one day said, announced to his readership, I'm closing down the IFSB. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was made all the more stranger by the fact that, you know, the group was huge. It had reached massive proportions, even without, you know, the benefit of anything like the internet. And the story that did the rounds in ufology at the time was that Bender had been visited by three guys in black suits from the government, specifically from the government, and told, you know, you're getting too close to things, back away, shut the group down, you know, unless you want any more hassle from the government. And Bender, the story was, sort of scared and out of his wits and did exactly what he was told. And the story, or that story at least, was written up in 1956 in Gray Barker's book, They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. Mm-hmm. Barker, for those who don't know, being an early investigator of UFOs in the 50s, and a very good atmospheric writer as well. And Barker wrote the story up, and the allusion was in that book as well that, you know, Bender's silences were from the government. Now, some people said, well, maybe Bender just made the story up to promote the group, you know, and give it more publicity. You know, and you could argue, well, that would be the case, or could be the case, if it wasn't for the fact that he quit ufology. You know, he didn't capitalize on it, he walked away. And the only time he ever came back to the subject was in 1962, when he wrote a book called Flying Saucers and the Three Men, which told his version of events. Now, his version of events, and then after the book was published, he vanished again for good.
Yeah.
But his version of events in 62 was that what actually happened was that the silencing had nothing to do with the government at all. He talks about how when he was doing his UFO research, you know, and it was at its height in the early years, sort of 51, 52, you know, he would go out at night and he would walk down to the local cinema and he would see these almost like shadowy wraith-like men in black with glowing eyes sort of lurking in the shadows. And the cinema apparently was hardly ever packed on a Saturday night, and he would see these, again, these sinister figures, so almost like predatory vampires sort of staring at him from the shadows in the corners of the seats in the cinema. He said they materialized in the attic, and he would sort of be rendered into an altered state and semi-conscious state, and, you know, the men in black would appear. And so, in other words, what is arguably, you know, the formative MIB encounter actually had, according to Bender at least, nothing to do with the government. It was far more sort of steeped in the paranormal and supernatural. As I said, almost like vampire-type overtones with the way these entities looked and sort of almost preyed upon him. And the upshot was that, as well as, you know, getting intimidated out of the subject, he began to suffer ill health, physical and mental health, psychological health. And it really sort of dragged him down, exhausted him to the point where he was like, you know, I'm just leaving all this behind. And that's exactly what he did. But it's interesting, you know, that today most people's views on the Men in Black are sort of provoked by the movie-type imagery of government agents, when, ironically, the man who really kicked it all off had an encounter with something that was far more paranormal than, you know, anything coming out of the Pentagon, shall we say.
How does the MIB persona or manifestation compare with this folkloric notion, in your mind at least, of tricksters and the trickster element that has this strange, ongoing, almost playful interaction with humankind?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can look at some MIB accounts and, you know, that they seem, in some cases, you know, there's a direct threat. In other cases, it's like the threat is almost like a ruse or like a stage play, just to see what the person thinks about the UFO encounter, you know, that the MIB has come to talk about or learn about or silence the person about. And I think when it comes to the trickster elements, whether it's the MIB specifically or the trickster phenomenon in general, what I think, whatever lies at the heart of what tricksters are, I think it's designed to try and teach us and elevate us at a mental level, if you like, you know, to open our minds to other realms, other paradigms, other ideas that sort of challenge the norm and the status quo. And I think sometimes, you know, the tricksters can be benevolent and sometimes they can be sort of downright malevolent. And people say, well, that's because there's good and bad tricksters. And maybe there are. You know, I don't rule that out. But equally, I think there's a valid argument to be said that, you know, sometimes you have to learn a lesson. Sometimes it has to be a harsh lesson. In that respect, that's what we could be seeing with the trickster angle, is that there's a phenomenon out there. And I really do believe this. I think when we start looking into different aspects of the paranormal, whatever the intelligences are behind the paranormal, when we look for them and we investigate them, it's like we come up on their radar and they recognize who's looking for them. Mm. And then they sort of turn the tables. And that's why those of us who go looking for these sorts of things experience a lot of phenomena like synchronicities, because I think the phenomena understands if you're legitimate about looking for answers, and when you go looking for answers, it kind of pushes you down the right pathway. But human nature being what it is, we don't always realize, you know, that sometimes a harsh lesson is actually a benevolent lesson. You know, we take it that it's something malicious or whatever. It may not be. So, you know, it's sort of a very difficult phenomenon to get your head around, you know, other than the idea that there are sort of paranormal forces out there, however you define the paranormal, which have the ability to elevate us and teach us if we're open-minded enough to listen. And I think the MIB play into this in some fashion.
Perhaps so. Although I would hope, maybe, that to a lesser degree, the creepy clowns play into that, because, again, I just don't want to have to deal with those clowns. I don't think anybody really does, let alone MIBs. But when it comes to that idea of the synchronicities happening more and more as you become involved in this kind of research, that's an interesting notion. And the hard lesson that Nick talks about there, it's kind of funny. There was so much work going into the event that I described at the outset of the show with George Norrie here in Asheville. There was so much work that went into it that there were times where I, along the way, almost was dreading it and just thinking, it'll be fun, I'm sure, but I can't wait till it's over with. But by the time it was all said and done, the synchronicity that was occurring, the great time that we had, the great turnout, the positivity of that event, yeah, sometimes the hardships are the lesson, but what we learn thereafter is all worth the wait and the trouble that went into it. More after this, we'll return shortly here on the Graylian Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And always happy to be your host here in the dark heart of the hollow earth, your doctor in space-time, and the man with the mouth up here in the high mountains of Appalachia. It is the Graylian Report. You know, we have had this month of August 2016 more downloads of this show than at any time before. We haven't put out more episodes. There hasn't been anything else that's happened that should have caused an unordinary spike. No, we've just been getting more and more downloads by a fair number, several thousands. And so this has been not only one of the best months, but also a fairly significant jump that we've seen. And that was even leading up to the event here in Asheville. So I don't think it was just people who saw it and went home and started downloading shows. This actually occurred before that. So I just want to thank all of you guys out there who, just by listening to this show, you're helping us get our message out there to more people. A very rational and often very scientific emphasis on the study of the unexplained. And of course, if you like what you hear, you can head over to Graylian X, which is graylianreport.com/X, and become a subscriber. You can get additional content as well as the monthly Graylian Enigmas. We'll have one of those episodes going out again here in just a couple of days. So yeah, Graylian Enigmas, in fact, is something Matt Oakley said. We should start packaging those separately when we do events and everything, and just allow people to have like a complete collection. Season 1, Season 2, we're going to be kicking off, I think, Season 3. We may already be in it, because technically I'm thinking 12 episodes per season, so yeah, I think we're well along into Season 3 now, but it's been a very, very interesting ride and a very interesting show. A lot of people enjoy that, so as a subscriber, you get access to Graylian Enigmas and, of course, the weekly additional edition known as Graylian X podcast. Specials that we feature from time to time, too. Lots of good stuff as well. Huh? Now, I want to get to a couple of listener emails here before we kind of revisit something that I did focus on over the weekend, which was we went further into exploration of the idea of the noosphere that Chardin, the French Jesuit philosopher, had talked about. And we mentioned that briefly in relation to a story about Vladimir Putin's new chief of staff recently on the show. But another of of Pierre de Teilhard de Chardin's ideas had involved what was called the Omega Point, as he called it. And this has kind of had me thinking spiritually, technologically, and otherwise, really where we are going as a civilization, where humanity is heading. And so we'll head off down that path here a little later in the program. But first, I do want to focus on a few messages from you. We've got some really good ones this week. So to kick things off here, Wade writes, I was looking for something about strange lights on the internet recently, and I came across your site. Now, this is the third time that I've seen strange red or orange lights over my neighborhood, which is near Somerville, South Carolina. The first two times, there was only one light. At approximately 8:50 p.m. today, I saw one of these lights, closely followed by three more. About a minute later, I saw another group of these, then a group of four, then a group of three. So 14 lights in total. My house is in the flight path of the joint base here at Charleston, but I have seen pretty much every type of aircraft in the U.S. inventory fly around here. I was also in the U.S. Navy, and I flew on EA-6B Prowlers. I know military craft when I see them. The thing is, these lights do not make any sound. And at one point, a small private plane seemed to have flown between two of the lights. I would estimate that their altitude, not much more than 500 feet, they appeared to originate from the direction of the airbase. The problem I have is that they looked like they just popped up from behind the trees across the street from my home, only further away. I thought I possibly had heard rotor blades, but you can hear the traffic on Interstate 26 sometimes from my house if it's quiet enough. As I'm sitting on the porch typing this, I just saw another two lights. All of the lights are traveling in a south to southeast direction, which would be toward the local beaches. I took two photos with my cell phone, but they are very grainy. I could send them to you if you'd like. He actually didn't close them. They were weirder looking than I had expected, I will say. And I think I really want to follow up on this. Wade states further, I'm a forensic investigator with the local police department right now, and I may try to set up my high-powered photo equipment to try and get better photos. These are no aircraft that I've ever seen. The light does not blink, and so they're not anti-collision lights on a plane or a helicopter. But on second thought, I'll attach those photos here. Maybe you can do something with them. Thank you for taking time to check this out. And Wade, I'll be following up with you about that, because for years there have been reports of these lights seen down there off the South Carolina coast, and everyone says that they, while sometimes are seen inland, they're a lot like, you know, Chinese lanterns or something along those lines. Some of them move a little more quickly, and they usually tend to head out toward the ocean. And right down there in South Carolina, I've heard from people for years who have said this. One woman had written to me years ago and said that ever since her childhood, she said, we always remembered seeing the little orange orbs that would come floating up out of the ground and head out toward the ocean. Now, a funny little tie-in that I will mention here, there have been a few earthquakes that have occurred down around that general area over the years. And you got to remember that in this region of the eastern United States, Charleston, South Carolina, and the Somerville area is maybe only about 4 hours away from Asheville. I've made that drive numerous times. And what I understand is that, again, the Brevard Fault exists through this area, and there is quite a history of earthquakes that have happened down in that general area. And I've wondered sometimes about, could there be any kind of a correlation between seismic activity or other kinds of things happening in that region and lights? Could these be something that are almost ball lightning esque manifestations similar to what we have occurring at Brown Mountain? Based on the photos I'm seeing, the description of the movement and the luminosity, the color, all of the factors that people describe with these lights seen down around Charleston, I mean, I have to say that the characteristics do appear to be sort of similar. And there was a scientific paper that Robert Theriault and a few others, John Dare had been one of the co-authors, and they'd written this about earthquake lights, and they'd tried to say that the Brown Mountain lights, you know, could always be correlated with earthquakes that happened here in the region. That's absolutely not the case, but I would nonetheless be open to the idea that there could be some sort of seismic or geological phenomena that is a contributing factor. What's interesting to me is the idea that perhaps the lights appear in other places, too, as a result of these underlying physical factors. That's something that we'd need a lot more data to be able to confirm. Dr. F.K. writes, Dear Micah, okay, all drinking games aside for a moment, I've noticed many times during the last few months that you use the word, I'm going to pronounce it correctly for you, Doc, erudite. He says, well, we cannot and will not add that word to our drinking game catchphrases until at least I make a humble attempt to correct something. The word is actually four syllables and pronounced so differently than the way you've been enunciating it that at first I was not even sure of what word you spoke. He goes into the correct pronunciation, but I got it, okay? Erudite. The whole dite part sounding like deet or feet or beat or sleet was killing me softly. So please don't take this the wrong way. I'm just a stickler for English. Call me Odd. Okay, Odd. So I love your show as always, and I listen to it the same way my grandfather listened to news from the front during World War II on my 1938 Philco floor console radio retro fitted with a Bluetooth receiver broadcasting from my iPad. You know, something about this is seeming so familiar.
I know that this is familiar, but I just can't seem to place it.
He goes on to say, I just happened to pick it up off of Craigslist up in Minneapolis back around the first week of October 2014. I mean, 2014.
No, not getting it.
Keep up the great work. Well, Dr. R.E.F. will say for right now. Yeah, something about this. Repurposing old radios with spare parts. Enabling them with Bluetooth devices. Nope, not getting it. Oh well, at least we've got the drinking game still, right?
Why don't you have a drink first? It's only human.
Close enough, at least. Although I will say that does bring something else to mind. Maybe if I head down there to investigate weird things in South Carolina, I'll make a little pass by the Carolina Bays, those unusual little shallow lakes, which some actually hold may be evidence of an ancient cataclysm. Yeah, maybe little bits of debris from a larger comet or asteroid that struck the Earth. Who knows? Who knows? Marianne writes, Hey Micah, really enjoying both Graylian and Middle Theory. Thanks for all your entertaining, incisive commentary, and keep it up. And the beautiful Desjardins quote from your recent Graylian report was the word that you said you didn't know, divinization. I believe that is actually. She said, This is one of my favorite theological concepts, and I think you'd find it interesting. It basically means a human can become like God or one with God through pursuing mystical union, ascetic practice, contemplative prayer, etc., with God in this life. It's more of an Eastern Orthodox concept and sometimes considered heretical in the West, where Christianity has adopted more of an incurable, low-down, worthless sinner approach to theological anthropology. So that's maybe why you're unfamiliar. I'll actually say that I do address this concept. I may have even used that term in the book Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule that I wrote a number of years ago. So actually, I'm quite familiar with that concept. It's going to be interesting if I go back and I find that I'd used that term and somehow didn't recognize it in the heat of the moment live on the air the other night, reading this passage from the former Pope Benedict. Marianne goes on to write, And people aren't wrong to be skeptical of divinization, also called theosis. I mean, look at all the abuses of power perpetrated by people who claim to be close to or one with God, and yet there is a strong mystical tradition of unity with the divine in every religion, and there's something so very compelling about the idea that we can experience radical spiritual transformation in this life, not just in some nebulous afterlife, and that indeed such transformation is what we're here for. These tensions are totally worth pondering because they apply to so many aspects of existence. Okay, I'm done nerding out, but thank you for bringing some high theology into the show. Take care, Marianne. I actually like getting into some high theology. It's another one of those subjects that probably, much like philosophy, modern physicists in large part would say is unnecessary. Yeah. In fact, actually, I would tell you quite the contrary. I think that the philosophical and theological perspectives on universal formation, the existence of a creator, and what role we all play in that are very important and worthy of study, maybe just as much as science. That reminds me of something else, too. Some time ago, and this was an erroneous assumption on the part of whoever had written this, somebody had written to me and said, you know, Michael, we know that you are faithless and have lost the faith and have no belief in a creator, but at very least you could entertain from time to time that the concept is at least something that your listeners might like to hear about. And I think that they may have further said something along the lines of, you know, you might learn some about this from your father if you talk to him. My dad's still an active member of the clergy. I don't know where along the way anyone ever got the idea that I did not believe in God. As much as I don't ridicule, but I certainly am a critic of the modern idea of atheism, I have said at times I'm rather agnostic. I even told Father Jack Ashcraft, my friend, one of my many friends in the priesthood, that, you know, there is a part of me I feel that is agnostic in the sense that, while I think that the true Christian doctrine teaches us that, well, you know what God is and what man's relationship with God is. I mean, if you are a Christian, these are fundamental truths that you know. But my science mind can't help but say, well, yeah, but is there more to this maybe than we really understand? You know, putting religion aside and putting, you know, the New Testament and the Gospels aside for Christians or whatever other religious holy texts, if you are of another religious persuasion, again, if we think scientifically and philosophically about the universe, what do we really know about the universe? How can we prove it? I don't think that these kind of things have to run in stark contrast to theology. I think that these are all a part of the broadening of our mind, our worldview, and our spirituality, and that these things scientifically, spiritually, and otherwise can work hand in hand. But it is a definite struggle at times, or a tension, as Marianne described it, to try and find that balance between the science mind, the theological possibilities about the universe and its formation, the philosophical questions that go beyond what science can yet answer. I'm interested in all of these things, and I will allow for all possibilities, and I personally do believe in a creator. I don't know where along the way anyone ever thought that they had nailed me, Micah Hanks, atheist. That's simply not the case. Although I am comfortable at times with the labeling of agnostic, but that doesn't mean any more that I don't believe than I would agree to being an atheist in someone else's mind. And I mentioned this on the Graylian X podcast over the weekend. I do take issue with things that scientists like Neil deGrasse Tyson say from time to time. I think, yes, he does come across as being a little arrogant, but I also really sympathize with the guy because he's very intelligent, and he has been not branded so much as claimed by the skeptic atheist movement. And he's talked about how he said, I never said I was an atheist. I'm not an atheist. And I think he, too, Neil Tyson, is very comfortable with agnosticism, although I think maybe in a different way than I would be. But he nonetheless uses that term to describe himself, and he says that I've actually tried to point out that, like on my Wikipedia page, I'm not an atheist, and I've had, you know, editors remove that, or editors have gone in and removed it. And he says the next day, other editors will go in there, what we would call the guerrilla skeptics. He says they'll go back and they will add it back in. They are so certain that I'm an atheist, despite my own misgivings for that term or worldview. But they have branded me. They have claimed me. They want me for atheist in chief. And he said, I'm simply not that. So yeah, I do think that there is room for philosophy, theology, and yeah, science. Yeah, we can deal with all of these things as fundamental aspects of our ongoing understanding of reality, as we will discuss a little later in the show. Jade, and this is my favorite email this week. Jade is one of my favorite email writers. And I've said that before because the way that she writes emails and the content that she provides, she goes above and beyond. And this email was so good that I wrote her back and I said, Jade, if and when I come out your way, she's a student, an astrophysics student. Astrobiology student. Misspoke there. But I told her, I said, the coffee's on me because I want to sit and I want to pick your brain. So she says, I don't know if you remember me, but I'm an astrobiology student. And besides the KIC 8462852, a.k.a. Tabby's star, the F-class star with a century-long dimming and periodic dips in its brightness that you described last week, there's another prime target for SETI, which may become news soon. She said, so far as of this writing, it only appears to have appeared on one reliable science blog, which is called Centauri Dreams. As you can see, an international team of radio astronomers, as cited in that article, using the 576-meter Rattan 600 radio telescope in Russia, may have detected something SETI has searched for. Though no one is yet saying it is of alien origin, many follow-up observations would be needed and have been requested, it nonetheless provides another very good target for SETI. Why is it interesting? Well, first, the star HD 164595 has a mass of 0.99 that of our own sun. In other words, it's almost like a twin sister to our sun. The star is also known to have a planet, and perhaps a planetary system. A planet half the mass of Jupiter was discovered around it. The system is 6.3 billion years old. Compared to our solar system, which is 4.5 billion years ago, if life arose on some planet in the HD 164595 system and took roughly the same amount of time as it took life to start on Earth, then such life could have had almost a 2 billion year head start and may have evolved to produce something much more advanced than us. The HD 164595 is relatively close to us in terms of distance. It's 95 light years away, making the system a prime target for planet searches and follow-up SETI observations. And in summation, if the detected signal were being produced by alien technology beaming it in our direction, such a civilization, would be what we call a Kardashev Type 1 civilization, a civilization... You probably heard Michio Kaku talk about this also, guys. A civilization which can harness all the power of a planet. Or if it were omnidirectional, it would be produced probably by what we'd call a Type 2 civilization, which is those which harness all the power of the star in their near star system. At this point in the email, I realized, oh, she's speaking my language. Now, it should be noted that SETI has had many candidate signals which did not survive reobservation, most notably the 1977 WOW signal detected at Ohio State University's Big Ear radio telescope. So while the chances that this signal persists and is confirmed as the product of extraterrestrial intelligence is quite low, based on previous history, there is a non-zero chance that perhaps we might learn we have neighbors not even 100 light-years away. Tabby's star, by comparison, we should note, is 1,500 light-years away. And by the way, I also wanted to address something one of your listeners wrote in regard to SETI and how the inverse square law would make our own common radio and television signals undetectable with our own technology beyond a couple of light-years. The assumption that we've reached the limits of sensitivity in terms of radio receiver and collector dish is false. In fact, the Square Kilometer Array, a massive radio telescope currently under construction, could detect the alien equivalent of our airport radars 60 light-years away, and SETI plans to conduct searches with it. More powerful radars, such as military early warning radar, would be detectable out of almost double that distance, in the very least. And lastly, Arecibo's planetary radar, which is frequently used to take radar images of potentially hazardous asteroids, and estimated to be detectable on the other side of a galaxy, an alien radio telescope in the path of one of these asteroid scans located tens of thousands of light-years away could receive its own WOW signal, which would never seem to repeat due to the fact that the asteroids approach on different trajectories, so Arecibo would be pointed at different parts of the sky while scanning them. That WOW signal would be received perhaps tens of thousands of years from now, if that were the distance between us and them, and that WOW signal would be from Earth. So, she concludes and says, "Love the science reporting you've been doing, as well as your rational approach to fringe topics. Best regards, Jay." And that right there is our email of the week, although I have to say it was almost hard to pick because there were so many good ones. Right, Doctor? P.S., you could have added, "You see, the aliens are building a wall around that star just like I want to do. Clearly they'd vote for me, Donald Trump," when you did the funny Donald Trump impersonation last week. What a segue that would have been. I'm glad other people think that the impersonations are funny. Again, I've said in the past when I've done those, I've had people write and say, "Well, you just lost me as a listener, Micah. Can you really be so easily offended these days?" Oh, wait, yeah. Yeah, everybody seems to be. Obviously, Jade isn't. Thank you, Jade. Oh, she says, P.S.S., also in response to Ed, the listener who said our SETI searches were based on what we want to find, I would just say SETI experiments are not really based on expectation, but on calculation of what is detectable with our current technology and what types of signals we may produce with our technology both today and into the future. So it's not a matter of fantasy, really, but of physics, specifically the physics of radio and microwave propagation. It's not that no one ever considered Ed's argument, though. It's just that that argument has been refuted by math and not magic. Now, I would maintain, in Ed's defense, Jade, that by the same token, there could be that possibility that extremely advanced extraterrestrials might be looking for similarly advanced alien life elsewhere in the universe, and that they could use technologies far beyond our own, but I'm sure that Jade would allow for that, and we even had a further correspondence in which she further elucidated on certain subjects, and in, dare I say, the very most erudite manner. She does a fine job. Jade, thank you so much. I look forward to further correspondence with you and with all the other fine folks who have taken time to send along messages this week. It is my honor, privilege, and pleasure to hear from you. info@micahhanks.com, info@graylianreport.com. If you would like to correspond with me or have information sent along, you don't have to send along a long letter. You can even just include links, and that's fine too. So, looking forward to hearing from you, and you guys all take care out there. We'll pick things up with a little bit of forward-thinking futurism on the other side of this break. It is the Graylian Report.
Hi, this is Jimmy Church of Faded Black. You're listening to Micah Hanks and the Graylian Report.
Solid light.
yes, just as she predicted. Jade was right. Here it is, space.com, only after she emailed me. The email came a few days ago, keep in mind. Yes, that's right, August 29th. Just yesterday, SETI team investigating mysterious signal from star 94 light years away. That's right, HD 16 45 95. Yep, and they cite the same Centauri Dreams article that she had sent along. Our listenership, that's how good they are. They're ahead of the game, at least by a few days. Good job, Jade. Thank you so much for that. You know, I want to look at some other stories that are happening in the news right now as it relates to the furtherance of technology and science. And we may revisit this exploration of the potential that this planet may be something far out there. By the way, that music you just heard was, yes, my younger brother, Caleb. That is the Nova Echo. The band's no longer together. Caleb isn't even doing rock these days. Right now, Caleb's actually doing, this is funny, an acoustic project with a bluegrass traditional lineup, and it's called Copernicus. So he and I both have that mutual affinity for astronomy. I, on the other hand, being known as an acoustic musician, everybody over the weekend was saying, is this Nitrograss? No, Nitrograss, as the name implies, is a bluegrass group as well, which Caleb is in. But Dakota's also in that band too, and Dakota was in the band featured over the weekend, which I was posting on Facebook and tweeting pictures in the back alley that we took behind Diana Wortham Theater. And that was Dakota and I on electric guitar and bass, and then Cody Britton on drums, longtime friend of ours, and then finally the newest addition to the band, Eric Saborski, the master of the 88 keys. So it's keyboard, drums, bass, and guitar, and we did all electric music, and I sing as well. And you wouldn't believe just how many people would come through the line and talk to me and say, Micah, you know, I've followed your UFO work and stuff like that, but I had no idea you play guitar, and wow, you really can play guitar. Yeah, it's no joke. I've been playing guitar since second grade, and I've done it professionally now for the last 10 or 12 years. And so I guess I've put in my time, and I really appreciate all the compliments from people. Even Tom Danheiser said, you know, I thought you'd be pretty good, but man, you shred. Well, you know, I've always said this, a musician's only as good as the band that they have, and I appreciate those compliments, but I'm going to have to pass those along to the band because they are just fabulous, and they did such a good job, really made the event. That said, I want to look a little further north, or at least to the Midwest. I'd mentioned a couple had come all the way down for this event from Chicago. I should have asked them about this because it's been reported now that the first of a network of data-collecting sensors that could one day blanket Chicago are now live. Now, the city installed two nodes containing computers and sensors, including low-resolution cameras as well as air quality sensors last week. They went up on traffic light poles at Damon and Archer Avenues in the McKinley Park neighborhood on the southwest side of Damon and Saramac Road in the heart of Chicago on the lower west side. The installation marks the launch of what is called the Array of Things project. This was conceived back in 2012 and originally slated to start by mid-2014. They're just now getting them off the ground. The project is a collaboration between the University of Chicago, Argonne National Laboratory, and the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. AT&T is the internet provider for the project, which is backed by a $3.1 million grant from the National Science Foundation. $3.1 million grant. That's roughly the cost of production of each individual episode of the series called Breaking Bad. Fun fact. Now, Charlie Catlett, director of the Urban Center in Computation and Data at the University of Chicago in Argonne, and a leader of the project, said that about 10 sensors per week will go up after Labor Day. By the end of the year, he expects 60 to 80 of these things, the nodes, to be up and running around the city. And by the end of 2018, the project aims to install 500 of them across Chicago. And then where thereafter, huh? They may be everywhere, huh? It's been a couple of years of research and development and testing at various scales, so it felt good to see a couple of them go up in the streets, Catlett said. Data from the nodes will not be publicly available until around the middle of October, when the project plans to release the data for free in a usable fashion on the City of Chicago's data portal and with the PlinR.io portal, which Catlett said is more suited to researchers than the general public. This reported by the Chicago Tribune. He said that the portals are not ready yet because they were a lower priority than construction and installation of the nodes. I'm sure Corey Kowal, who's been a guest on the show in the past, he and I are hoping, once my schedule settles down, to engage in a new project that'll kind of look at stories like this. So, Corey, if you're out there listening, make note. We'll definitely want to follow this one. He said that the team will have to capture images at different times of day and in different weather conditions to ensure the software works correctly, and to do so, images will be transferred to a secure server at the University of Chicago. Now, later, the images will be analyzed by N-node computers, then destroyed after a period of time ranging up to tens of minutes once the data is extracted from them, he said. The inclusion of cameras in the nodes raised privacy concerns, and this is where I was going with this. I had wondered about how soon before people would say this. It raised privacy concerns among some citizens and experts. The city recently finalized a privacy policy covering some details of how data will be used. Critics pointed out that the policy did not address how the project would handle law enforcement requests. Catlett and other proponents of the Array of Things said that the big data it collects will help the city run smarter by tracking traffic patterns, detecting flooding, and analyzing air quality in certain neighborhoods, among other things. He said that the team is partnering with similar groups in other cities, starting with Seattle in partnership with the city and the University of Washington. There we go. Similar groups in other cities. They'll also partner with groups in Chattanooga, Tennessee, two cities in the United Kingdom, Bristol and Newcastle. Catlett and those partnerships are likely to start in early 2017. What do you guys think about that? Info@MicahHanks.com. Would like to get your thoughts. Obviously, there are going to be very good things about being able to monitor everything from air conditions to flooding, traffic patterns. Yes, law enforcement may be able to find this useful. It's supposed to be made public, this data. Now, that is potentially a good thing in the name of transparency. Is it also potentially invasive? People are being watched. Will certain people in certain parts of the city be more prone to being potentially surveilled utilizing such technology? Does this raise eyebrows along with concerns over the Big Brother state in that Orwellian classic 1984? Might have gotten here a couple of decades late, but it does sound an awful lot like that. Now, in terms of modern technology, is it something that is to be feared? Will the good, will the pros here outweigh the cons? I would guess those are still questions that we'll have to answer at some point, but I'd love to hear your thoughts about this. Info@MicahHanks.com, info@GraylianReport.com. The emails come both to the same place. I check them every day. I'm not able to get back to all of them, and I regret that. So if you don't hear back from me, my schedule seems to be increasingly busy these days. I thought after the event I'd have a couple of days downtime. The very next day, I was getting phone calls from people. How did it go? People already wanting to plan new events. I've had two or three such requests already, in fact. So, yeah, things just have not slowed down yet. But I hope maybe at some point this year they will. Yeah, so I do try to read all the emails, even if I'm not able to respond. And more these days, I respond on air. So if you don't want it to be read on the podcast, please tell me in the email if you want me to withhold your name or if you don't want your email read at all, and I'll keep it private. But looking ahead, so we are looking at new surveillance technologies and new possibilities afforded us by such technologies that are paving the way to a new kind of a future, a brave new world, to borrow from Huxley. And yes, we've already borrowed from Orwell, but it does sound kind of like that, doesn't it? Now, if you think that's interesting, CNET reported, and this is maybe the big headline of the day, a new human-led epoch. Scientists recommend officially declaring a new age of man. They say that the impact that the human race has had on Earth is so intense that scientists are recommending we move on from the Holocene and into a new epoch. We'll break this down a little bit. CNET reports air pollution, climate change, population growth, massive rainforest loss. The effect humanity has had on the Earth is undeniable. And in the last 60 or so years, since the time just after World War II, this change has seemingly accelerated. Now, so much that a group of scientists have recommended we officially enter the Anthropocene epoch, denoting a new age of man. We'd be moving out of the 11,700-year Holocene epoch. After 7 years of deliberation, the 35-person working group voted 30-3, with two members abstaining, and they voted in favor of registering the change. On Monday, they submitted their recommendation to the International Geological Congress in Cape Town, South Africa. Our working model is that the optimal boundary is the mid-20th century. This according to University of Leicester geologist Jan Salasiewicz. If adopted, and we're a long way from that, the Holocene would finish and the Anthropocene would formally be held to have begun. The approval process will take 3 years and requires three other academic bodies to ratify the registration. But boy, isn't that interesting. We may, if this is approved, again, they're saying that sometime in the middle of the 20th century would probably actually mark the boundary. So if this is approved, it will be determined. We're already in now a new epoch. We are in the Anthropocene. And so when I say that we are in a new era of humanity, well, it's going to take 3 years to determine whether we're already in it right now. That is big news. That is big news. What does that mean about, you know, life right here on Earth? I mean, nothing's going to change overnight all of a sudden because we've announced the Anthropocene. But it is something that should cause us, I think, to consider not only the impact we're having on the Earth, but the technologies we'll be utilizing in the future and where we'll be going with them. Consider this. This has been a rather controversial story, okay? And we had covered it right here on the Graylian Report. A while back, there had been some skepticism about it. This is involving what is yet to be determined to be the first human head transplant. And the National Post reported recently that we have our cast of characters that starts with Valery Spiridonov. He's a 31-year-old Russian tech geek who runs an educational software company from his home in Moscow, but he has what's called Wernicke-Hoffmann disease, a genetic disorder that wastes muscles and motor neurons. And so, at this point, he's physically incapable of doing much more than feeding himself. He can steer his wheelchair with a joystick, and of course he can type. The disease is usually fatal, and the doctors expected him by now, in truth, to be dead. Now, Xiaopeng Ren, age 55, is a Chinese surgeon who, when he lived in the United States, was on the team that performed the first successful hand transplant. He practiced it for first by switching pig's forelegs, and he keeps in his office a bronzed pig ear that the transplant team sent him as a trophy. Kind of an odd thing. Now, and then we have, this is the character who's rather controversial, Sergio Canavero. He's a 51-year-old, described as flamboyant Italian neurosurgeon who compares himself to Dr. Frankenstein. This is rather unsettling, but he mentions Nazi Dr. Josef Mengele and has written not only dozens of respected scientific papers, but also a guide on how to seduce women. In 2013, he announced he wanted to try to transplant a human head. That's right. Now, you can probably see where this is going. Canavero and Ren apparently say they want to perform this transplant, and Spiridonov has said that he will volunteer. Sam Keen apparently wrote a story about this project, and it was published in the Atlantic magazine. It's been described as deeply weird. Canavero says that the transplant could happen as early as 2017 and has a 90% plus chance of success, and if it does take place, it would require 80 surgeons and cost tens of millions of dollars. But many scientists and ethicists have derided the project and said it's junk science. So they say it raises false hopes. One even says that if Spiridonov dies, a not unlikely outcome that the doctors should be prosecuted for murder. To me, that would have a lot more to do with whether or not Spiridonov actually has signed a waiver saying, I realize I could die as a result of this, but, well, it's either death, which is eventual for him with his condition, or it is perhaps a new lease on life with this transplant, if it works. But many are saying it's junk science. Part of the controversy about this guy had also been the fact that Canavero had a remarkable similarity to a character who was a doctor who appeared in, like, a video game. You may remember this if you're a longtime listener. And some people had even begun to ask questions. I think Sharon Hill at the Doubtful News website, been a guest on the program in the past too. Sharon has even talked about whether this is indeed a legitimate story, whether this is not just some hype. Again, I think the biggest red flag I see about Canavero is, I mean, I'm sorry, you've written a book about how to seduce women. Okay, well, anyway. Keen weaves in history, science, and entertaining detail in the Atlantic article. Doctors would color-code the severed muscles of Spiridonov and the brain-dead body donor to make reattachment easier. The surgery would be done with a transparent diamond blade. The procedure probably would take place in China because it would not be likely to be approved in the United States or Europe. And it says the story raises interesting questions as well. Even if Ren and Canavero can do the surgery, should they? If the donor body belonged to a pianist, would its muscle memory enable Spiridonov to play the piano? Who would the surviving patient be? Would it be Spiridonov, or would it be some kind of amalgam? That is an interesting question. If a head transplant occurs, what part do we identify as the individual, the body or the brain that's attached to the head that's just been transplanted onto the said body? It is rather Frankensteinian, isn't it? Frankensteinian. That reminds me, you know, we lost another great one over the weekend. Do you remember Gene Wilder? Yeah. Star of so many films, and of course, one of my favorites, Young Frankenstein.
Oh, Frederick, Are you all right?
Yes. Would you excuse me for 1 minute, dear?
Oh, of course, Doctor.
Igor? May I speak to you for a moment?
Of course.
Sit down, won't you?
Thank you.
No, no, up here. Oh,
thank you.
Now, that brain that you gave me, was it Hans Delbruck's?
No.
Ah. Good. Would you mind telling me whose brain I did put in?
And you won't be angry?
I will not be angry.
Abby someone.
Abby who?
Abby Normal.
Abby Normal.
I'm almost sure that was the name.
Are you saying that I put an abnormal brain into a 7.5 foot long, 54 inch wide gorilla?
What?
Is that what you're telling me? Quick, get up!
That's a classic, and I'm sure that you all will remember that film. That's sent along by Abby Norman, not Abby Normal, on Twitter, who is a brilliant little writer, I have to say. She is quite good, and you can follow her. I think she's Abby M. Norman on Twitter. Yeah, quite funny, and do appreciate that link. Once again, it's just been quite a year for losses. Gene Wilder, MTV was recently criticized for not paying tribute to Prince and some of the other fallen artists, David Bowie, over the last year. Yeah, so I mean, it's just been one of those kind of years. But coming back to Frankenstein, and again, this idea of if a head transplant is successfully carried out, what is the amalgam that is produced? I mean, as we're seeing our potential entry into a new epoch, where is humankind headed? I mean, I don't mean that necessarily in just a rhetorical sense. I really mean, are we entering an area where the divisions between body and self, you know, the role that humanity plays, and perhaps the long-held and contentious debate over whether we are alone in the universe, I mean, are all of these things going to be not merely science fiction and the stuff of the imagination, but in just the next few years, the stuff of the reality around us, the science fact that we deal with on a daily basis? We'll conclude this discussion on the other side of this break. It is the Graylian Report.
You're listening to the KGRA Digital Broadcasting Station, Van Buren, Arkansas, Sarasota, Florida.
From the dark heart of Appalachia, it is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. A little gonzo dubstep here for you. You know, more people tell me this is their favorite song that they hear on the Graylian Report. That's right. We do feature a lot of original music here in-house. And, of course, occasionally that of other artists we like, such as Beth Arzy and Trembling Blue Stars. Yeah, a few others out there, too. Monkey Warhol is another one. If you've got music you'd like to send along, you can send that to me at info@MicahHanks.com. From time to time, we will feature such music here on the show. So, who knows? Psychic technologies. And I say technologies because eventually those things which we consider relegated to as yet unproven powers of the mind may be quite possible with new technological innovations of the coming years. Are we looking at a future where we actually transcend humanity itself? We become so adept at changing not only our environment but ourselves that we actually cease to exist. It is a post-human era. And what exists beyond that? You know, some people, rather than viewing it as the end of humanity, they see it as the natural progression of things. I don't know if Pierre Teilhard de Chardin would have said the same, but he certainly did believe in this, what he called an omega point. But I think that he saw this as an enrichment, a fulfillment, a union, kind of like the Greek concept of the monad, oneness with the Creator. But then again, you also have people like Ray Kurzweil, who, when asked, do you, Mr. Kurzweil, believe in a God? He says, well, no, not yet. Implying essentially that in the coming decades, perhaps gods will exist. But then again, how do we define a god? A creator? Well, how much creation do we do? You know, what happens when, in the divine scheme of creation, the evolution, which has been something of nature, is taken into our own hands, and we are the ones who steer the direction of our own evolution? Or is this all just too far out there? I mean, I think if we don't wipe ourselves out completely, or if no great catastrophe comes along and destroys everything, as again in the ancient past we've certainly seen to have happened, if perhaps we get to a point of technological proficiency that if said disaster were imminent, it could be warded off, could we, you know, again, direct an asteroid away from slamming into Earth? Could we prevent, or even if necessary, move off planet? Are there ways that humanity could continue on unhindered as a result of technology and technological development? I'm mystified when I think about looking at the history of science and what, you know, so little as a century ago, people said will never be. That will be impossible. Look at the world of today. And yet there are people today that are saying that the innovations that we expect just in the next few decades, it will never happen. I've got some of my friends in the skeptic circles, the UFO skeptic circles, and I might use that term friendly a little loosely here, but I don't like enemies. I can respect anybody's opinion whether or not I agree with them, but I've had some of my friends saying that, you know, this transhumanism stuff is all completely bunk, artificial intelligence ain't never going to happen, jetpacks ain't never going to happen. You know, last time I checked there, I mean, they may not like be able to carry you from one continent to another, but last time I checked, jetpacks already existed. I mean, there are people who are so skeptical that I think that in truth, all they really are is just doubters. They are negativists. And I think that the reality before us is one where we, as an engineer told me a while back, a friend of mine, he said, you know, I'm not much for skepticism. Because really, if all of the people who work with the space program, or the people who work with intelligence agencies, or the people who work in medical laboratories, the people who work in agriculture industry, if they were all skeptics, we wouldn't move forward, we wouldn't progress, we wouldn't be able to tackle all the significant problems that appear over time as a result of our own human involvement. As we move forward into the Anthropocene and out of the Holocene, are we looking at a new era, a new epoch, which will be fitted with new problems, but with the affordance of technology, with mindful and with responsible, conscious, and perhaps also physical evolution? I mean, will we move forward ever into the future in positive ways? I mean, those are choices I think that we can all make. And yet we still see an awful lot happening down here on Terra Firma right now that really seems to be just the opposite of the kind of utopia that many foresee. I don't know. I have no idea. And I want to be careful. I mean, here's where my skepticism kicks in, too. We have to be really careful because a lot of people these days are getting evangelical about where we're going and what it all means. I remain hopeful, and you people out there who listen to this show on a weekly basis or who correspond with me or who come out to the events that we do, you know that I remain hopeful. I am cheerful. I'm a friendly person. I like to smile. I smiled so much Saturday night, and this is no exaggeration. I was smiling and talking to so many people and being friendly that my face actually hurt. Maybe the nanobots one day or the gray goo will be able to help with that. I can smile all night without my face hurting. That, or maybe I'll have to talk with Nicholson's Joker. You know, a little bit of Brand X wouldn't hurt, right? You'll get a grin again and again. But I digress. 450,000 people out there somewhere just took a shot. Where are we really headed? I do remain cheerful. I do remain hopeful about the future of humanity. But sometimes I do think it's also important for us to stop, and we have to take, well, maybe we have to have that sobering moment. Maybe it requires a shot. And we have to stop, and we have to revisit that old maxim, with great power does come great responsibility. We're becoming more powerful. We're becoming more technologically proficient. We need to always remain cognizant of the direction that we are headed with the utilization of such new and profound innovations. I think that's going to be the final word this week. Thank you to so many of you out there who do send along emails, who do subscribe, and who do support what we do through listening and interaction. I'm at Micah Hanks on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. Also, info@MicahHanks.com for emails, and visit the website for updates, MicahHanks.com and GraylianReport.com. I appreciate all of you out there. If we can be cheerful and we can look hopefully to the future, let's do it together. That's cosmic love, baby. Indeed, on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Studios, Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Matthew Oakley, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Racing Robin Hobbs, Jeremy London, Tyler Pittman, I remain your doctor here in the dark heart of the Hollow Earth. It is the Graylian Report. We'll catch you guys next time, and as always, stay strange out there.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website GraylianReport.com.
Thank you for all the gratuitous information.